Hello and welcome to Table Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Bendix Stenerson.
And I'm your co-host, Dr. Rebecca Stenerson.
Today's episode number 5, we're happy to have one of my close friends and co-residents, Dr. Bryce Green. Dr. Bryce Green has come all the way to Florida from South Dakota and taken many steps along the way throughout the country doing various different things. Bryce is unique because he kind of took a different path than Rebecca and I. He's had a full career in between, but recognized his passion for medicine and decided to go back and did a lot of his medical school prereqs after having, you know, like the traditional undergrad path. So I'm very happy that he's here to share his experiences with us.
Well, thanks for having me, guys. I really appreciate it.
So, you know, just to kind of give a little background, you know, you can start off, what was your first exposure to medicine?
Well, My journey has been a really long one. Really, the very first time that I ever actually considered medicine was actually with my niece. So when she was 1 year old, I literally actually remember hearing my sister scream, right? So I'm like in the basement of my mom's house at the time, and I just hear her scream upstairs. And it's like this blood-curdling, like something is very wrong type of thing. And I go running up the stairs and I see my niece, who's 1 at the time, sitting in her high chair having a seizure. And, you know, I have no idea what is going on, of course, at that time. And so just kind of, you know, freak out. And I grab her and I just look at my sister and go, call 911. Just call 911. I don't know what to do. Like, just call. She stopped seizing after however much time it was. And then she wasn't breathing. She was starting to turn blue. And I started looking at her. I'm like, okay, how do we go about this, like not knowing anything? And I open her mouth and I see that she actually has like fries and stuff like still in her mouth. And so I ended up doing like the little baby Heimlich maneuver. And she starts breathing again. And then next thing I know, you know, the ambulance crews is kind of coming into the house and take her away. You know, kind of looking back at it, like I really feel like that's kind of what started it all. Because at that time, I just sat and I was just like, oh my God, what just happened? Like, what happened to my niece? What did I just do? Like, what did I just do? Like, how, like, not even understanding, like, the thought process. And frankly, from that time, I was scared, you know, like, because I was like, this is something that I've never seen before. I've never dealt with before. But then at the same time, so I was like, I never want to feel this way again myself, like not knowing what to do in this type of situation. And at the same time, I was like, God, I can't imagine how other people feel. Like when they see something like this, when they go through something like this. And so at that point in time, I was like, you know what? This is something I think could be worthwhile to pursue, is looking further into this. And so actually at that time, I decided, hey, you know what? I'm actually going to go and become an EMT. Not really even knowing what that entailed in itself. And so that's pretty much where I got the overall start from.
How old were you at the time?
I think it was 18 when that happened. So it's been a couple years.
Yeah, it's awesome. I mean, we talked about one of our episodes. In medicine, we have thinkers and we have doers. And for some people, it's, you just have like an instinctive like, oh my God, I just got to do something, right? And some people, not that it's right or wrong, it's just how we act. And it's kind of amazing to think at how different we as people react. You know, call 911 is a pretty, you know, obviously what you have to do, because you got to get them to the hospital, you know, in this case, a loved one. There's a lot of things that can happen between the time of them arriving to where, you know, your house or wherever you are, and then getting them to the hospital. So there's a lot of things that happen in there. And, you know, some people just have that instinct that they just want to do something to see if they can fix it, which is pretty remarkable. That being said, I guess we should probably go back a little bit. You mentioned this was about 18. I obviously know, but if we could share with everyone else kind of your path from, you know, maybe high school, graduating, what your initial thoughts of like what a career for yourself were. Was it medicine at all? Or, you know, here we're talking about, you know, you had an instance, you decided, hey, I think I'm going to do EMT. Like, what was your path like from high school kind of to medical school, and now here we are in Florida together mm-hmm. in transitional years?
Yeah. So, and that's kind of the crazy part where we just kind of got this total like side quest type thing going on. So for me, that really was my goal, is just because, you know, at the time, just working at a dead end job, and I really had no idea what I want to do as far as a career path. And so I'm just like, oh, you know what? I'll just sign up for this course. Like I actually had no desire to complete school to begin with. I was just like, yeah, I can just take this course at a technical school and kind of go from there. I'll just go work in ambulance for a while and kind of see where that ends up taking me. And it's strange now that I think about it, because I was totally happy with like that just being the course of my life and not thinking about it. But, and so that's where I went. As I was talking to my instructor, you know, she's like, well, you know, you can't really just do anything with just this, you know, you got to look further than that. And so she really kind of inspired me to just to move further. And so I ended up doing an associate's degree of fire science at that time, because that kind of made the most sense with basically just going and being an EMT, especially in South Dakota, where a lot of the ambulances are actually run by the fire departments. And so that's kind of the route that I ended up taking. Well, for me to then work at the fire department, I needed experience. And so I ended up actually traveling around the country, working at a couple of different national forests and national parks, doing the wildland firefighting. And from there, I eventually got onto the fire department. And when I got into the fire department, after about a year, I had asked them, you know, hey, would you guys send me to paramedic school? And that's kind of how I ended up getting into that. And so, I mean, fast forward several years, you know, this is now 2010 when I started there. So I ended up going through and completing my paramedic, getting my license there, and then started working about 50-50 on the ambulance, maybe a little bit more on the ambulance kind of at that time. But then that basically, for folks that don't know, you know, there's various different levels of providers that are out of hospital. And so, you know, the EMTs, they can provide the basic life support. You know, I mean, it's a lot of like kind of stopping the bleeding, you know, providing a little bit more basic stuff. And then as a paramedic, you can go deeper and like doing things like intubations or IVs, giving medications at a much kind of more invasive level than you'd be able to do like just as a normal provider. And kind of my overall goal as I was going through that really was, I love what I do and I want to keep doing this. I want to keep providing care to people. And then moving, you know, beyond that, like, again, I was perfectly happy. Like, I'm like, nope, I finally got this career spot. You know, I've been here for just a couple of years. I'm really happy with what I do. I love my job. And then I got hurt. And I think that was probably one of the most devastating things for me. I had been married for literally just a couple months at that time. And I began thinking, okay, so I strained my back. I'm in my early 20s. Actually, I blew out one of the discs, and I'm going through and I'm looking forward and I'm going, okay, well, I've got to do this job for another 20 years. Is that going to be physically possible for me? Now, I mean, looking back at it now, yes, it probably would have. But at that time, I was so scared of not being able to provide for my family or not be disabled. And I think that was one of the scariest things, is because I was looking at some of the other people that I was working with. I was going, man, these people are literally living with chronic pain for their entire lives, day in and day out. And they're doing this job to help other people, but I don't know how much they're doing to help themselves, kind of thing. And it scared me that was going to be essentially my life. As I was kind of going through it after that initial injury, I started talking to my wife. I was like, hey, what can I do? You know, I literally was like, well, what is something that you can't give up? Like, if you were to leave this career, what is something you would regret for the rest of your life giving up? And for me, it truly was taking care of people. There's something about that bond that you're able to make with your patients, to be able to help them, to walk them through whatever is going on, you know, even if it's something super simple that like for them, for some reason, it's an emergency, you know, or they don't know who else to call. And so they call you, you know, with us being on the ambulance at the time. And for me, there was a lot to that, but that was really what it was. I just never wanted to give up taking care of patients. And so taking a look at it, okay, well, so there's, you know, some of the big major things where I would go from paramedic would be, you know, PA school or nursing school or becoming a physician. But I'll be honest, you know, I never imagined that ever. And I was like, well, you know, here's the options, you know, PA or nursing school. And my wife was like, why don't you just go be a doctor? Like, literally just how she said it. Just it's just that easy. Just go be a doctor. It's fine. And I was just like, okay, well, let's look into it. I mean, what's the worst that can happen? And as I was kind of going into it, I started looking, okay, here's my contingency plan, right? Is I literally took a look and I was like, well, so I can take all of these prerequisites and that will qualify me for medical school. And they go perfectly in line with what I would need to go into PA school. So I'm like, okay, so let's look for a degree. Like, what degree could I do that would qualify me for these things? Now, keep in mind, I'm still working 6 hours a week is basically what our average work week was. We were 24 hours on, 48 hours off. Pretty manageable. So at that time, I was really actually looking for online courses. So I was looking for an online undergraduate degree, preferably one that would also accept my associates, which I found, not really. You know, it just kind of depends on the type of options that you want to go into. And so for me, I ended up basically bouncing between, I think it was 3 or 4 different universities all under the same umbrella of the University of South Dakota, and doing online courses for all of my really undergraduate studies, and then grabbing onto any in town or like within 45 minute drive for all of my science courses that I needed to be in there and present for. And so basically, you know, I was switching shifts all the time with people, trying to make sure that I could go to my classes. And so I was working full time, and I was doing full time school for 3.5 years, basically, to be able to try to get through all of that at the same time.
And when you started that, how long had you been working as a paramedic and firefighter? This happened with your niece when you were 18. And then at this point, what age were you at when you were kind of wrapping up those credits for the prerequisites?
Yeah, I would have been 32 when I actually finished off with my undergraduate degree.
And you had a lot of clinical experience, really hands-on experience then at that time, working as paramedic. And this was all in South Dakota. Tell us a little bit about that, the kind of things that you were seeing, what kind of experience you had being a paramedic that you felt like really helped you.
So it's kind of interesting. When it comes down to it, there's a lot of different things that you can pull apart that gives you really good experience. Well, for me, you know, in some cases, it's really nice to be able to just look at a person and be like, okay, they obviously need something more than what I can provide them or whatever. You know, they need a much higher level of care. And I just, the overall acuity of patients, I think, has come a little bit faster for me than what I've kind of seen for some people. And I feel like I've been a little bit more comfortable with certain levels of care for patients a little bit faster. And I think that was one of the things that helped me along through the journey. I truly think the biggest thing for me that it helped was the connection with people. And I think a large part of that is because you're sitting in the back of an ambulance. You know, for me, I mean, my short trips in the back would be 5 minutes, and my long trips could be, you know, 12 hours. I mean, depending on where we're going to. I mean, granted, that wasn't most of them, but we would routinely transfer patients from Western South Dakota to Mayo Clinic in Minnesota. And I would take a bunch of those. You know, during that time, you're not like talking to a patient like the whole time. But at the same time, you know, I mean, you got to be able to establish a rapport with basically anybody that you're sitting in the back with. And you got to be able to, you know, get them to tell you information that maybe they haven't told to anybody before, you know, and there's a lot of trust and faith that people have in you, and just kind of that amount of confidentiality that you kind of have between you two. And, you know, frankly, being able to share a little bit of yourself sometimes can be very beneficial. But I think that really overall, like, those were the biggest benefits.
Yeah, I think that's funny because we talk a lot about, you know, medicine's about being smart, but from some of the best doctors that I've seen, it's the ones that connect best with the patients. And, you know, what can you do? It's not to say that everyone has to go and do a side career for X amount of years before going to medical school or deciding they want to do medicine. But, you know, everyone has like this unique thing for them that kind of sets them apart as a doctor. And the sooner you can build a rapport with your patient, the sooner you're going to get the vital information to kind of ultimately help them. And I think already at this point, we can say, like, this interview is kind of, if you're not inspired to go to medicine right now and that you can do it. And we talk to people like friends and things that kind of at times feel like, you know, it's too late, or, you know, if you want to do it, you can. And, you know, you're a testament to that. You took, you know, years off from school and you went back, you figured it out. You knew it's what you wanted to do. You had a connection to it from an early age, which is awesome. That kind of drew you to it. And then you decided to do a career that ultimately is super, what we've talked about before, is like super beneficial to going into medicine. Cause it, like you've mentioned, establishes a lot of these high acuity settings that show, can you do it? Do you want to do it? Do you like doing it? Which I think a lot of people, you know, forget about. This is your career. You have to really love and enjoy. And ultimately, you mentioned it too, sacrificing time, effort, a time away from your family, which, you know, you've shown that you can do it, which is pretty amazing. And I'm super proud to call you one of my co-residents. I've loved working with you. I know that the rapport that you have with your patients and with us as co-residents and our attendings, there's some people that just stand above. And, you know, I think part of it for you is like your path to where we are today. So that's pretty awesome.
Thank you.
And one thing I think that's really difficult too is trying to learn how to have the discretion to get the information you need in the time that you have, and especially in the situations that you've dealt with and meeting someone on one of their worst days, you have no information about them or the situation or their history, and you have to determine what's important and get that information and communicate that appropriately. I'm sure that you have a number of different stories that come to mind even just thinking about that, but I think it helps, you know, in that regard too.
Yeah, I really do think that that's something that's been very, very beneficial. You know, I mean, it feels like so much of the job is actually just information gathering, because I mean, that's where we base really a lot of our clinical decisions. I like to think about it too, kind of going along. And one of the things that kind of inspired me also as I was going through this is in some of the doctors that I was speaking with after I got hurt, you know, I ended up actually seeing a PM&R doctor. And at that time, you know, I mean, I'm a young guy and I'm like, I don't know that I want to have back surgery, man. You know, that's pretty young. And just seeing, you know, some people just don't respond well after that type of thing. And he goes, okay, let's work with it. And it's weird, but like, I didn't realize that was an option. You know, like patients actually can have a choice in their care. I don't know why, but like when I was just that young, I just kind of never had that in my brain that was an option. And I think that part of that was kind of the mentality I had with where I was working, that it's like, nope, just get it done quick and move on and move forward and just keep pushing through.
And before we get into talking about, you know, the steps after and applying to medical school and all that, everything we've talked about up to this point was based out of South Dakota. Did you grow up there?
So yes, I did grow up in South Dakota, Western South Dakota.
What was that like?
It's really interesting because, so while I grew up in South Dakota, my wife grew up in Long Island. And it's really interesting just because our childhoods were so similar. And I never really would have expected that, but it's kind of funny because we'll be like, oh yeah, you remember that episode of that TV show or whatever, you know, that was on when we were kids. And I'm like, oh yeah, we'll just start talking about it, you know? And I mean, the biggest difference is like the sports that she was exposed to versus what I was exposed to. But I think that that's kind of interesting that it feels like because we grew up in different parts of the country that sometimes our experiences are extremely different, and sometimes they certainly can be. But for me and my wife, at least with our experience, like it was actually very similar, just a normal, like kind of childhood, how you'd expect, you know?
And did you have anyone in your life when you were younger that was a physician or had gone through medical training or?
Yeah, I think it's funny because everyone has the notion like, oh, you're a doctor, your dad must be a doctor, but you know, neither of our family members, no one in our family was, and so let you speak to kind of your story, but it's always like a funny question and always helps kind of set the picture as to how hard it is to do for some people that don't have that like initial draw and connection to medicine.
Yeah. And I had zero exposure. So my mom, I mean, she had been an EMT, but the reason she had it was because she was working at a juvenile detention facility. And then she eventually ended up getting basically a medical coder license. And so that's really the closest that I'd ever had to anybody within medicine right there.
And then kind of what I'd like to get into now too is just putting all those credits together. Did it end up with you like applying to one type of degree, or how did that all work out in the transition between taking all of those classes and studying for the MCAT and then getting into those next steps?
As far as the actual degree is concerned, I went for one that I could use some of my credits from my undergrad or from my associate's degree to apply to my undergrad. Unfortunately, all of the science classes that were needed to go to medical school were the ones that they would have filled. Those would have all been electives. And so essentially, I had to start from square one for my entire undergrad. For a lot of that, it basically meant that, you know, I was just kind of starting over with everything. And trying to also study for MCAT at the same time. And then overall, as far as the MCAT went, not super well.
Agreed. There suffered that.
And you know, did you take the new one or the old one?
I took the new one.
Okay.
Not that old, come
on. Well, we were kind of on the border too, and almost made the cutoff to take the old one, but ended up taking the new one too. It was, I think during that time that it was introduced, it was hard to find information and how to study for it, and there was a new section. So it was difficult to strategize how to take a test like that, because in undergraduate classes, it's more clearly communicated what information you're expected to know. And the MCAT was just different setup. It's a longer test. You have to strategize differently. Yeah, how did you go about that?
So yeah, that was certainly one of the struggles that I had with it too. I think that really my biggest struggle when it came down to it was going, my God, there's all these resources, and all of these resources are guaranteeing you that, hey, you're going to get the highest score. You're going to, you know, look at all the achievements that we've done, all this, that, and the other. And it doesn't matter. I mean, the thing that I think matters the most, frankly, is the resource that you use, you know, and the one that you stick to, and the one that goes into medical school also, you know, the resource that you use and are comfortable with is going to be your best one, you know, assuming the information is good too. But I think that all of the companies that are out there, I think that they do a really great job at presenting the information that's needed for these exams and these tests. I think the problem lies in our anxiety, frankly, when it kind of comes down to it. Because when you decide, hey, this is the path I want to go down, you want to do everything that you possibly can to get there. I feel like that's the hardest part about it, is like, okay, well, so I need this one, and I need this one, and I need this one. And I mean, needless to say, I think I had like 2 or 3 different companies worth of materials, and I was, you know, half-heartedly using each one. And it's like, I think that's honestly where I really struggled with it. And if I had just dedicated my time and efforts into a single one and really just been like, nope, this is what I'm using, that would have been the best thing for me.
And that's a theme that really recurs as you go through training with, you know, COMLEX and USMLE. You really just have to make a decision and be persistent and discipline to stay with whatever you decide first.
Yeah, it's to say like the best one is the one that you use, right? And I mean, I remember back to myself when I took the MCAT, I took it 3 times. Every time I used the same one, and that was just because I felt comfortable, I knew it, and I was just like, I'm going to use this one again because I've learned 50% of the information. If I could just take it, restudy again, I'll learn 75%. And the last time I was like, you know, I got to learn this whole book now, you know, it's like, it's hard, you know, you do the best to learn as much as you can on the first try. You hope that things you learned in your undergrad classes were relevant. For us, like when I took it, you know, the biggest thing for me is I never took a sociology class, and that was like a whole section that they added to the MCAT, which crazy the way things change and how much, you know, resources are out there. And, you know, do you really want to spend all that money on 50 different things? So just doing the research to find what's best for you and going with it.
Yeah, you know, and I think a big part of that kind of discussion too is figuring out the ways that you learn the best too. I mean, going through med school, you know, and this is jumping ahead quite a bit, you know, tons of people use flashcards. Those don't work for me at all. Not whatsoever. It's kind of funny because, you know, I'll see all of these people, like everybody's using flashcards, you know, getting through this huge amount of information. What my brain will do is literally memorize what the card looks like. And then I'll bring up the answer. I'll have no idea what the text actually said, but that's how it does it. And so I would be going through these flashcards for hours a day and not be able to recall an ounce of information that I actually went over. I would only recall the keywords. Once I finally realized that and changed to something else, I started doing quite a bit better.
So how did you study for the MCAT? What was your process?
Honestly, how I ended up studying for the MCAT was a lot of like reading and taking notes over like some of those, you know, one of the big text reference books that they have, and just kind of going through and just kind of hammering through it that way. And I don't necessarily suggest that for anybody. I'm pretty far removed from that now, thankfully. Sorry, guys. But I know it really is like, find the way that you learn. Some people will learn very well by watching videos. Some people will learn very well from going through reading books, taking their own notes. And maybe other people, you know, I mean, you need something that's more of an in-classroom type of thing, where you've got more support. And unfortunately, that just for me was not something I was going to be able to do just between working and trying to do school at the same time.
So transitioning now to, you know, you're doing undergrad, you're taking the MCAT, you've taken several years, done your EMT, paramedic, different life, it seems like probably. Did you go directly from undergrad now, completing undergrad, MCAT, did you go directly into medical school? How was the medical school application process for you? Did you, you know, only apply one cycle, multiple cycles? How did that work?
Sure. So, and actually like you, I ended up taking the MCAT three times before, you know, I got enough of a good score where, you know, people would consider me. So with that said, you know, in my, would have been junior year of grad, that's when I took it the first two times. And then I didn't take it again until after I had completed, you know, the senior year, had completed my full-on degree. So I had a gap year, but it's kind of funny because I never realized that that was actually a gap year, which we can talk about the interview stuff. So I never realized that that was a gap year because I was still working at that time. So it's like, you know, when most people think of a gap year, they're like, oh yeah, okay, so you had some time off or what did you do? And I'm like, what are you talking about? Like,
You think about the big lull that was just like an empty blank period in your life, but you know, you'd already, you started a career, you continued it through school, which is like unbelievably impressive. And then, yeah, like you said, you just continued working, hoping for the next step to kind of work out. So it's pretty crazy.
You know, and that's the thing too, is that I realized during that time, which could be significant for some folks too, is that number of cycles that I went through as far as applying, I went through two cycles. The first cycle is kind of like how the traditional, you know, a lot of folks will end up applying in their junior year thinking that they will then be able to start the summer, you know, directly after they have graduated. And so that's how I tried to do it too. My first year didn't go well. I actually didn't have any interviews whatsoever for my first year. It was obviously pretty disheartening. And I was like, okay, no, you know what? This part of this has got to be literally because of my MCAT score. I just need to keep working on this. I need to keep boosting this up. I mean, granted, kind of like you, not having taken sociology, like I didn't take biochemistry, and I think I still was missing like one of my like OChem or something like that, you know? And I needed to make sure to really buckle down on those. But with that, having gone through the first cycle, my wife and I look at each other and we just think, what if this doesn't happen? We can't stop our lives for this. We're both getting just a little bit older. I mean, we're not old by any means, but we decided to start a family. And so we actually brought our first son into the world with us during my last year of my undergraduate.
So, wow.
Just after undergraduate.
So you're doing undergraduate and MCAT and applying to medical school and working full time and you have a baby.
Yeah.
That requires a lot of time management.
Yeah. You know, I think that the biggest thing is when you decide that this is something that you want to pursue, you got to hold on to your reason for it. It's kind of funny. One of the things that my medical school really hung on to, and I actually really appreciated that they did this, like the very first day, they said, hey, what was your why? Why did you want to be a doctor? And it was this silly exercise where we just sat down and we wrote like a couple paragraphs or whatever. It's like, hey, what is your why? Like, why do you want to do this? Why do you want to be a doctor? And what I truly appreciate about it is that when we were going up to the podium, they handed us an envelope. And within that envelope was our own paragraph that we wrote for what our why was.
That's amazing.
You think that it's really important to kind of keep that in mind at all times, just not necessarily living in the past, but it's more like, this is why I decided to do this in the first place. This is why this was important to me. And if you kind of live with that as a reminder, like within your heart, I think it really can kind of push you forward. So for me, that's kind of part of what that has become a little bit.
Yeah, and Rebecca and I have talked a lot about, you know, the challenges that we face, different than yours, different than other people, you know, but you got to want to do it. And it's good to have that reminder. And it's unbelievable that, you know, they kind of gave you that. That's super cool. I did that in high school, like our freshman year to like senior year. And it's nice to have like reminders to kind of look back on. And it's like you said, not to get fixated on the past, but a nice reminder, a little boost that you genuinely want it. It's not just, you're not just doing a job. You're doing it because like there's something that drives you inside for who you are, for what you want to be, for what you want to do. That's amazing.
And you wouldn't go through everything if you didn't have that reason.
Yeah.
All the steps that it takes over decades, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
And tell us a little bit too about, you know, now going through that second cycle, what that was like.
Like, what did you change, I guess, from, like, I guess that's the biggest thing. What did you change from the first cycle to the second cycle? You obviously, you know, the MCAT, maybe we can, you can pinpoint it to that, but, you know, you have real life experiences in medicine that should push you above and beyond people, but maybe it wasn't enough the first time. What did you kind of tweak the second time around? Or did you tweak anything? Or when did you just go at it, you know, hammered and say, you know, the commitment? Obviously, I think that's a big thing that happens in medicine too, where these administrators, these deans, they want to know, how committed are you, right? It's just like, we're just applying to see for fun. Like, maybe I'll do it, but.
Yeah, you know, I'm trying to think of what all I changed. The biggest thing really was me being able to, number one, complete the courses. I mean, that they suggest you complete before you take it. But then, you know, I started going, okay, well, you know, all I was applying to in my first cycle was MD schools, specifically US-based MD schools. I wasn't looking into the Caribbean. I wasn't looking into DO. And I went, okay, why do I have this bias in my head, I guess? And I kind of started like opening my eyes to that, like, hey, DOs are doctors too. You know, what's the difference here? So I was like, why don't I apply to DO school too? Why is this even a separate entity? You know, obviously we know why now, but you know, at that time, I honestly, I had no idea. I'd never even seen a DO in South Dakota. There's very few of them there. And so I didn't know what it was like to be a DO. I didn't have any background. And I think that when I went through into that second cycle, I opened my eyes more. I was thankful in that I was able to find a school that was willing to see that I had my eyes open. And I think that was one of the big things, you know, because when people are looking at the differences between just an MD or a DO, you know, frankly, as a patient, you don't care. You just want a doctor in front of you, right? You want somebody who's going to be able to clinically make the best decision, to be able to take care of you, who you're able to connect with and who you can trust, you know, and who cares what the initials are. And that's eventually what my thinking was, is like, what does it matter for me if I wouldn't care who it was that's taking care of me?
I think it makes a lot of sense too. And we had an osteopathic school connected to our undergrad. So we had kind of had that exposure earlier on that what DO education was like. And some of my friends who were older had gone to DO schools. You're familiar with it, but it wasn't even, you know, 5-10 years ago really explained in the same kind of way, and people didn't know a lot about it. There were only, even now, only 7,000 something DO graduates every year. So it's still a smaller population going into the residency match. The AOA has done more of a job, I think, in providing education to patients and the public about what DO schools are like. But if you don't know and you haven't met a DO, there's not, you know, a reason that you would know to really apply to those schools, especially because they have their own application system, even though the residency applications are all merged now. So it's kind of funny to think about. I don't know if the MD and the DO schools will eventually combine how you apply to medical school. It'd make it a lot easier for students, but
it'd be nice. It'd be nice.
We'll see kind of how the trends go. But tell us about your DO school and your experience there.
Yeah, I ended up going to Pacific Northwest University, which is in Yakima, Washington, the dead center of Washington, with not a lot around except for hops farms and grape fields, which is, I mean, pretty interesting, I guess, if you're into that. So for, you know, for us there, our starting class was something like 144 people. But the big thing with us is because we were associated with several different hospitals, but we actually covered a 5-state region. And so we were sending people up to, you know, Alaska, but then also down into Oregon. I ended up in Montana, you know, some of my friends were in
For your clinical years.
Yeah, for the clinical years, for the third and fourth years.
Curious, when you applied to the school, did you know that was how it was going to be structured?
That was part of why I selected the school, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. So, and not the only reason, mind you, but I just, the overall feel from the interview, you know, in speaking with some of the physicians that were there, it just kind of, I felt like I was able to click more kind of with them. And I remember, like, you know, one of the doctors, you know, going back to previously, you know, not having any exposure to osteopathic medicine, he's like, so what do you know about osteopathic medicine? And what's your exposure? I was like, hey, you know what? I'm just going to be honest with you. What I know about osteopathic medicine is what I was able to read on the internet. And frankly, I can regurgitate that to you, but what's that going to do? Like, it literally does nothing for you. You know, it does nothing for me. And so I'm just going to tell you, you know, I didn't have exposure. And the reason is because, you know, there's, I think, only literally a couple hundred providers in South Dakota that practice it at all, you know, or that are DOs, let alone whether or not they practice osteopathic medicine. So I told him, you know what? The thing is I'm just interested in it. And like, I think that it can be kind of cool. I really don't know much about it, but I'm really interested in learning. I think that was kind of part of it, is I was actually genuinely interested, just because, you know, it's a different way of maybe looking at some problems more than anything else. You know, in some cases we can provide different things besides just medications. So I think that's kind of where one of the big differences in it really lies. You know, there's a lot more of a kind of a holistic approach to medicine that basically every medical school is starting to take now. And I don't think that that was the same in the past. And that was kind of like osteopathy's kind of claim to fame, so to speak, is, you know, really working with the patients. I don't think that that's necessarily the case anymore. I think that they still have a little bit of a different approach that can be very beneficial for people. So that I really felt like I tuned in with.
And especially in the OMM classes, just getting that really hands-on experience with the musculoskeletal system and interacting with people who have different musculature, body types, things like that. It just, I think, gives you a different kind of perspective.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of funny because when you, and now that I'm kind of thinking more back to it too, I remember like being a third year medical student and, you know, obviously I'd already had patients in the past and everything else. And like, I go to do an assessment on a patient, going and speaking with whoever my attending was at the time, and be like, oh yeah, you know, here's their physical exam. They looked at me like, wait, you touched them? And I'm like, was I not supposed to? And they're like, well, no, you can. It just, most people don't. It's a physical exam. Like, but I think that a lot of that, you know, both like with the past, just being the paramedic, but then also with the osteopathic background, yes, you know, the people that we're working on, they're all the students, you know, and they become our friends and we get close relationships, but just that level of comfort that you get from, you know, touching, assessing somebody and then treating them, you know, I think that goes actually a long way early on that is really beneficial.
Mm-hmm. And we had a lot of older doctors when I was in school really emphasized, don't lose the art of the physical exam. Ironically enough, I'm a psychiatrist, so now my version of what's important for a physical exam is a little bit different. But it still goes back to the point that you're getting information from somebody through that by interacting with them and talking to them. And that's a really valuable art in itself. Mm-hmm. And that gives you a lot of good information today.
So now looking forward, I mean, or looking backwards, really, we haven't even mentioned, you know, what you're going into. So you decided to go into PM&R, physical medicine rehabilitation, like myself. You kind of mentioned or alluded to that, you know, with your back early on, you know, working as an EMT, paramedic, firefighter, you hurt yourself, you saw one of them. And I'm assuming that's kind of what sparked your interest going into PM&R. And, you know, here you are, shipping back across the country in a couple weeks to start PM&R residency.
Yeah. So yes and no, honestly. And it's kind of funny, you know, backtracking just a little bit too. Just before I went for my interviews for when I finally eventually actually got in, I hurt myself again. Herniated the same disc over again. I remember going into those interviews, talking to people, not being able to feel the entire left side of my leg, of one of my legs. And it was just gone. There was nothing there. Just pain. And so I remember like going in and like in my head, just going, don't let it show. Just don't limp, just walk normal. Like, no, but you know, I mean, but it's one of those things where it's just like more reason. Like it's more like, yeah, no, I need to move forward with this, you know, and this is supposed to be the right direction I'm going in. So I ended up actually needing to have surgery at the end of all of that. So I had surgery and then I can't remember how it was. It was like a couple weeks later or something like that, we moved across the country to start school.
And we also didn't talk about too, tell us a little bit about your time in school, how you balanced your family life with that, and if it was impacted by COVID at all.
Gosh, yeah. To go along with that comes another wrinkle. Because as I said before, we said that we did not want to stop our ability to have our family while in school. And so we brought our second child into the world during the first couple months of med school. So there wasn't a lot of balance.
How was that the second time around, now balancing with being in school versus when you had your first child and you were working? What was different? What was better or more challenging?
So I think that the biggest thing is kind of really what it comes down to is having the relationship that my wife and I were able to have and being able to really kind of set boundaries and expectations for certain things and kind of knowing that beforehand. Thankfully, truly thankfully, my in-laws ended up coming and staying with us for several months to help my wife with, you know, the newborn and with our other son at that point. So they came to help out, you know, just kind of in that regard to make sure that everybody was doing okay. But then it was kind of, as far as it was for me, it was me talking to my wife, hey, listen, you know, from 7 o'clock in the morning until 5 o'clock at night, every single day, this is school time. Whether I actually have class or not, this is my school time. And then what I'll do is I will come home and I will have a couple hours set aside. And this is going to be family time. And this is going to be dedicated family time that I will be here every single day to the best of my ability and make this happen. And then from there on, I will try to do things, whether it's, you know, taking care of, you know, one of our kids, you know, he needs to be fed, whatever, and need to stay up a little bit longer. I'll read and I'll study at the same time with him cradled in one of my arms. That can be a mixed time, but this will be the dedicated time to school and then to family. And then this can be a little bit of a mix, but come exam times, when we get a little bit closer, that's when we had to have a little bit more flexibility. And then when it came to the weekends, there was one day every weekend where it was, this is just more dedicated study time. So I would actually frequently go to the school on the weekend and just be at the school the entire day, just studying. And then I would come home and it'd be just the exact same thing. And then one day was completely off where it's only family. And that's basically how I kind of tried to balance that as much as possible. Now, as far as COVID is concerned, that's where another wrinkle got in. So just before COVID happened, one of my sons was diagnosed with autism. And so he, at that time, was 18 months old. And so between him being 18 months old, having a diagnosis of autism, taking a look at, okay, so these are types of therapies that we need to start trying to get him into to make sure that he, you know, is able to interact with others, or so that he, you know, we make sure that he can speak, he can play, he can do everything that he needs to do. Between that, but then also taking care of a newborn, that became a very tough decision. Essentially, what ended up happening at that time is my wife and two kids, they moved, and they moved back to New York. And so they were in New York during the entire second year of my medical school during COVID times. Being what it is, that was probably the hardest year of my life. Now, mind you, many people have much, much harder, you know, and I've had a truly blessed life for that to be the hardest year of my life, but it truly was. Trying to not feel like I had abandoned my family in order to move forward with this path over that same time. I think that was kind of one of the biggest struggles. So essentially what we would do is, you know, since they were several hours ahead, is to make sure that I got to see them, because my oldest was doing a lot of therapies, things like that, again, we're going to be over Zoom and things like that. To make sure that I even got to see them, I would wake up at 5 a.m. every day. And I would wake up at that time just so that I could FaceTime with them. And that's what we would do. That was just the morning routine. You know, they'd be sitting down eating breakfast, you know, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. And I would be chugging my coffee as quickly as I possibly could, because my goodness, that's too early. And that's kind of how we ended up living our year. I was able to fly out there over Christmas break and spend some time with them. But other than that was the only time that year that I actually got to be physically with my family.
Yeah, I look at you like Superman, you know, you can do everything all at once. So it's pretty remarkable all the things you've done over the time. But the other side of that is obviously having, you know, just a stellar support system. And, you know, Rebecca and I talk about that, and we were fortunate to have each other, and she was a couple years ahead. When I started school, she kind of understood where I came from, but not everyone's in medicine and has that understanding. And then, like you mentioned earlier, you made this decision together, which is awesome. Mm-hmm. And you set this expectation that you wanted to provide. You had a dream, you had a drive, and you recognized that, and she recognized that alongside you, which I think is hard in a lot of instances for maybe people that are not fresh out of undergrad that are, you know, have a life, and then you're talking about, wait, you're going to go back to school and kind of restart life. And in a way, it's, you're resetting everything. It's hard, and but it's fantastic to know that, you know, you were able to set those expectations early on. And we talk about that, you know, in medicine, set the expectation early with this person and that person. And, you know, if that be your parents, your kids, you know, it's hard. And then obviously you have little kids, so they don't fully understand kind of what all that's like. But like you said, I mean, like, and like I said, you're Superman, dude. You're a stellar guy, and you made that happen. So that's awesome. And it's not something that maybe everyone can do. And there's, this is just another challenge that goes into fulfilling the dream and getting through medical school. And then here we are in training, working long hours, and you still find a way to, you know, make time for them. So it's fantastic that you're able to do that.
You know, when it comes down to it, I think the hardest thing for us, and thank you, I disagree. I definitely do not feel like Superman. I feel like I'm fraying at the edges almost constantly. But I think the one of the biggest things is that talking about setting these expectations, you know, it's easy to say set expectations with other people, but it's a whole nother thing to be able to do it, right? Yeah. And you need to have an open and honest conversation with the people that are around you. But to be honest with you, I think one of the biggest things too is to set those barriers and expectations for yourself too. Going into medical school, I never once thought that I would be at the top of my class. I was nowhere near, and I'm okay with that. If I had gone in thinking, all right, all these people are so much younger than me, I'm going to kick their butts because I know so much more than them, I think that I would have crashed and burned, because I would have set my expectations way too high and not taken a clear look at what I actually have also. And you need to understand that like, you know, some people are, you know, the quote unquote gunners, so to speak, and they want to be the best. There's something in them that needs to be the best. Everyone that's in school, as long as you finish and you graduate, you are a doctor. You want to do the absolute best that you possibly can. But I think, unfortunately, what people focus on is the grade, and they don't focus enough on being a doctor, being somebody that connects with people, being somebody who, you know, you can do well on a test, but that does not mean that you know medicine. That does not mean that you know your patients. And quite frankly, I think that that means so much more than any letter grade that I could have ever possibly gotten.
Mm-hmm. And you see that transition when you get into your third and fourth year of school and you go out onto rotations. How was that experience for you, given that most of the second year was online?
So it was phenomenal. My gosh, it was absolutely phenomenal moving to my third and fourth year. Number one, because I could be with my family again. But then number two, because my biggest why was being able to talk with patients, being able to connect with people, and being in the books and in the classroom for so long was extremely difficult for me, because that was when I needed to remember my why the most. Because when I'm able to be around people, that's just a constant reminder just in itself. Funny enough, I think the hardest transition for me was going back to living with other people again, because I essentially became this hermit during my second year of medical school, where I would talk to my wife, I would talk to my, you know, a very small core group of friends that I had at medical school. But other than that, like, I had my routine, everything was constantly like in its place. I had my like daily cleanup, and then I had my weekly cleanup for my entire apartment. So it was just, yeah, it was just spick and span at all times. And then I come home, and now I've got two kids, and it's just like chaos and toys everywhere. And oh my goodness, like,
it's no longer your routine, it's their routine.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. Like, I'm actually trying to fit myself into their lives at this point.
And what's difficult too is in your first and second year, you're in school, your hours are kind of predictable. And then your third year, every rotation could be different hours, different location, different staff. And you have to adapt your routine every single month, every single time you change a block.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that again, you know, kind of going into, okay, here's the expectations, right? And you know, so I would say to my wife, hey, you know what? Okay, this one is a family medicine rotation, you know, so I'm working 8 to 5 every single day, you know, and I hope to get off early this day or this day, but I don't know, but I'm going to be here from here to here. And then here's my surgery rotation. I'll be there from 6 to 8 p.m. I don't know, you know, and
that's 6 a.m. to 8 p.m.
Yes, yes, thank you. You know, and it's like, you just don't know. And I think those are the ones that I struggle the most with. But then you keep in mind, you know, I mean, for a lot of those rotations, you know, at least for us, it was either 2 weeks, 4 weeks, or 6 weeks. And so, you know, I would just think, okay, I can do anything for 4 weeks. I can do anything for 6 weeks, right? It's just, you know, you just got to remind yourself of that, you know, that really in the scheme of things, that's not that long. And so, you know, it was almost like every rotation, here's what my general hours will be. And so this is when I can hopefully expect to be home, and then just kind of go with it there. Kind of going back again too, I think that one of the biggest things that I kind of try to do is when I go home, I'm home. With residency, you know, I mean, this is another kind of jumping way forward, but with residency, it's really easy to go back on your phone and be like, oh my gosh, what was this patient's lab? I need to know this, you know. You don't need to know that. What you need to do is you need to reset yourself, and you need to be in the here and now, whether that's with your family or whether that's with your own self-care. You need to do that. You need to set those boundaries on yourself. And the earlier you do it, the better off you will honestly be. I truly feel. And I think that was something that in medical school was probably one of the best things that I've kind of carried forward, is trying to make sure that I have those boundaries with myself, just because I see myself as falling into that trap. I would see myself like on the internal medicine rotations going, oh, I ordered this, you know, this biopsy of this patient who I'm concerned has cancer. And is this pathology back yet? Is it back yet? It's like the pathologist went home at 4 o'clock, dude. Like, it's not coming through at 9 p.m. Like, you don't have to look. But I would find myself doing that. But then that's taking away from my family. And when I see that, I think that right there is the biggest detractor. And so being able to kind of set those boundaries for yourself is extremely beneficial.
And learning how to do that in medical school too, and then carrying that forward. And I think it helps you be more present at work too, because you know, this is the time I need to resolve everything while I'm here. I need to be present and focused and check all my boxes before I leave, because I see people struggle with that even through residency and feel like they can't turn that off when they go home. And it's true, like you say, it does detract from the people around you who are at home.
Yeah, and I totally agree. You know, it's not a matter of just like showing up to work. It's a matter of showing up to work, doing your job, giving 100%. And it might be exhausting. You might be a little more tired at the end of the day, but, you know, knowing that you did what you could during the day, like, I love our hospital. You know, we have a really great system with the handoff. So we know that if you do your job and you do your job correctly, you can pass on the information to someone. And if there's something that comes up that's urgent, emergent, there's someone there that's going to handle it. And then if not, you know, you're going to be able to check it tomorrow. But knowing just like when you're there, give it your all. You can go home resting, you know, kind of peacefully, knowing like, I did my job. It's time to reset. Take care of me. It's a lot of pressure. So knowing that you just did your job, you can go home, rest peacefully for 8, 12 hours, whatever it be, and then, you know, doing it all again the next day. So,
and then tell us too, how you decided on physical medicine and rehab, PM&R, which is, and we've talked about the match statistics in some of our earlier episodes. It's a smaller specialty, so there's not a lot of positions available. And you had that experience seeing someone in PM&R with your back injury before. What made you decide on that? And then what was your application process like?
And not going into like emergency medicine or something, one of these like really high, fast-paced things like you were used to from your, call it, prior career.
Sure. You know, as far as emergency medicine is concerned, I'll just cover that one just because it's a much quicker answer, frankly. The big reason I didn't decide to go into emergency medicine is because I enjoyed the longer term relationships that I was able to foster with people. A lot of the long term relationships you foster with people in the ER is because they're there a lot. And whether that's because of, you know, some of the social issues that they're going through, or because they're extremely sick and they have nowhere else to turn. It just wasn't exactly the type of situation that I wanted to be in. Although I very much did like the hands-on, the fast pace. I think that the shift work was also a little bit more difficult for me, just because, at least in medical school, it was just kind of constant rotations, you know, days, mids to nights. And you know, overnights, and you don't really necessarily know when you're going to be around. And I wasn't a big fan of that instability from that aspect. And I know that as an attending, you can have that, but that's not exactly the exposure that I got. And I didn't see that in a lot of the attendings that I worked with, because that's not how their physician group was made up. So I think that that in itself kind of answered that question for me. As far as why PM&R, so had I not actually seen PM&R with my back, I never would have considered it. I truly never would have. And mostly it's because I would otherwise have never gotten any exposure to it, other than being at the hospital going, hey, look, that's a PM&R doc. What's PMR? I don't know. I got to do this. And that's most medical students' exposure to it. And I think that's truly unfortunate. But as I was kind of going through it, in my mind, I was always thinking, you know, okay, I don't really know what I want to do. Like, I know PM&R is an option, but I want to make sure that I'm diving deep as I possibly can into all of these different specialties, because I don't know what I want. You know, I just know that, hey, I want to be able to take care of these patients in the deepest level that I can for me and in things that make the most sense. Essentially, I started going, okay, what was I most drawn to, right? And I would go back to my first and second years of medical school, and we were all systems-based. And so I would go, okay, well, dermatology, no. I'm good. Sorry. I know some phenomenal dermatologists. It just wasn't for me. It didn't speak to me. And it's like, okay, well, good, because I don't have the grades anyway. So, hey, there we go. But then we go further down the line. And eventually I was like, man, you know what? I really love neurology. Like, I don't understand a lot of it, but oh my God, it's just fascinating, you know, how cool just neurology is. And then I also just really enjoyed musculoskeletal just in general. And I think that a big part of that also goes into just the fact that I went to a DO school, just because, you know, throughout the entire school, you're talking about just different aspects of the musculoskeletal system. When I was like, well, okay, I really like these two. So what are the main specialties that are within these areas? And I'm just like, oh, look, there's PM&R. Huh. Yeah. Okay. And so I'm like, all right, well, it's there. And like, it's literally like calling to me, and I'm like, okay, that's fine. Don't commit. Because again, I want to do this deep dive. I truly tried to do that, you know, between internal medicine, between surgery, even between emergency medicine, even though pretty early on, I was pretty sure that wasn't good for me. You know, I ended up not being able to get a rotation in it. And for the longest time, like, so I'm in my third year, and that's generally when you're trying to do a lot of like your core rotations, your family medicine, your internal medicine, your surgery, where frankly, most folks end up going into. And so it's great to be able to get exposure for that. For me, like, I'm like, okay, I need to make sure that PM&R is something I actually want to go into. And I could not get a rotation in for the longest time. So I'm like, all right, well, I'm just going to be like applying for sub-I's and just hoping, you know, that like I go to the sub-I. And it turns out that yes, this is exactly what I want to do. Well, thankfully, a PM&R rotation opened up like 2 months before I go on the sub-I. So thank God, chef's kiss, it was perfect. Because essentially what I was able to do is I was able to jump into this rotation. It just kind of confirmed everything for me. It truly did. So the physician I was working with at that time, she actually had a mixed practice to where she would be working at an acute rehab hospital, but then she was also working at an LTAC facility, and she was working at a clinic. She had her own clinic. It was amazing. Absolutely. Like, I mean, she was superwoman, but she literally did a little bit of everything. And I loved the fact that I got to rotate with her. I love being able to see if this is what I would want my life to be. I could truly do all of that too. But then also seeing the different interactions she had with each patient in each setting, I felt gave me a really good broad basis of, you know, what base PM&R specialty could end up being. So I think that kind of going in it from that aspect and seeing what that truly meant, I was like, man, if I don't get this now, I think I might actually be in trouble. Like, I don't know that I will feel like I fit no matter where I end up going. And so from there, I ended up going to my sub-I, and did that ever just confirm it even further? Like, it was just like, do I have to leave this place? Like, can I just stay in this place and just kind of finish my residency and not have to go anywhere else? Just please keep me. Yeah. But I think the thing is it truly was. It was finding those patient interactions, being able to develop the long-term relationships with them. You know, interestingly enough, I think that having been a paramedic beforehand helped me a lot too. Because, you know, when you're going through it, you know, you think about, okay, you've got these people who are going through these crazy days, right? Possibly the worst day of their life. That's why they called you. And trying to settle all these things down, you know, really quickly, trying to get that information. Well, on this side, everything is calmed down. For the most part, a lot of these patients are stable. But now what you're dealing with is you start dealing with the realization that they may well be disabled for the rest of their lives. They may well have a completely different future from what they ever thought they were going to have. I mean, I was lucky. I got to work on the spinal cord unit with a wonderful physician, and he himself had a spinal cord injury. And my God, talk about inspirational. I mean, he had a spinal cord injury just before he got into medical school, or he like got into medical school and then like had it happen. I can't remember which it was, but, and knowing that he was able to go through all of that. And it's just like, no, look, it's all about adaptation and figuring things out. And this world is not necessarily built for you. So how do you build your mind around this world and not taking necessarily like a victim sort of mentality, but trying to go, oh, I have to adapt and overcome and move forward. And I absolutely loved that. And I loved trying to help people make it through that. I loved seeing people get better, you know, and they're devastating things that happen to folks. And that's why they're there. But I love being able to help walk them and walk their families through these things. And ultimately, I think it was a lot of those relationships, a lot of those seeing what I could do to help them and seeing the team aspect of it too. My God, the team aspect. Like, I feel like that is one of the one area of medicine where if one part of it fails, like the rest of you can really feel it. But when everything is going right, like, you know, I mean, between, you know, physical therapy, speech, you know, you've got your social workers that you're all trying to coordinate with, getting somebody to be able to go back home into a remote village somewhere. Think about that. You know, somebody lives in a remote village. How do you get them a wheelchair? How do you get their catheters changed? How do you, you know, I mean, maybe they've got a colostomy, or maybe you need to make sure that they're getting continued wound care. Somebody's checking on them. And all they want to do is they want to get home. They want to be with their family. And I feel like so many people will go, well, just move to this more populated area. Think about if you had to have that yourself. And I think that being able to meet people where they are and find out their goals and their objectives, and then seeing what you need to do to be able to get them there, just kind of that whole intricate process of working with all of these people. I fell in love with that process.
And for people who don't know too, explain a little bit what you might see in an acute rehab setting. Or a place where you might work if you end up in PM&R, since it is something that medical students don't commonly know about, and even people in the general public, really, unless they've themselves or a family member have gone through a significant illness, injury, accident, or whatever it be that leads to them going to a rehab. What is that setting kind of like, and what kind of people are you interacting with?
Sure. So, I mean, and it kind of depends on the different settings that you end up going into. What a lot of people think about when they think about PM&R doctors is they are doctors for nursing homes. I mean, there's a lot of PM&R doctors that's exactly what they do, is they will run a nursing home. You know, they'll go in and out of patients' rooms, you know, see, you know, if they've got, you know, a large home, see however many patients that they've got a day, and make sure that they see all of them within their week's time. And then they kind of repeat that and go back through. And so like that would potentially be one aspect of it, you know, is people who are in like more of that kind of assisted care that requires 24-hour nursing. There are PM&R doctors that will work for large hospital systems where they're just on the hospital floors. And what they do is they'll do evaluations for Medicare and Medicaid, seeing if they would qualify for an acute patient rehab, or if they need to just go home with home health or physical therapy, speech therapy, things like that. Or will they qualify, you know, under like the Medicare guidelines to go into a rehab facility? That's kind of that hard delineation too, because a lot of those rehab facilities will require a patient to do 3 hours of physical therapy every single day or 5 days a week. it's kind of a hard line to deal with, because you have to be unstable enough where you require 24-hour nursing care, but then stable enough where you can still do this therapy. Or, you know, at that point, do you go to a nursing home then and kind of get an hour of therapy a couple times a week there? But that's a whole nother section. It's just doing those evaluations constantly. And then there's others that will work at, you know, long-term acute care facilities, which, you know, they're basically kind of tending to the patient's needs where they're still very unstable, or they're critically unstable, essentially kind of like not quite ICU, but I mean, needing a lot of assistance with, you know, just their blood pressures, their overall like health recovery. You know, they'll still come in and make sure that they're moving, making sure that they're getting the appropriate people, physical therapy and things like that that they could need, and essentially like discharge planning for where they'll go from there. And then you could end up in like more the rehab hospital setting, where you're the physician who's in charge of, you know, however many patients within your hospital. And there you could be taking care of, gosh, Benedict, you'll have to help me out, but like, I mean, you could have like a stroke floor, you could have spinal cord injuries, you could end up having, you know, your traumatic brain injuries. I mean, there's people who will do like post-cancer treatment or during cancer treatments. You've got like your post-cardiac arrest folks, or, you know, a lot of folks that are going through like major respiratory rehabs. Then you've also got like a whole nother population of like people who have just, you know, had traumatic injuries. So like, are they now an amputee, you know? And essentially how I kind of look at it is it's kind of like just care for patients who have either acquired or congenital disabilities. And that's, it's kind of a weird thing to place into a nutshell, because the thing is quite frankly, you can go so many places. And I mean, that in itself is just the base PM&R. And from there, there's so many other subspecialties that you could potentially go into that could take you into any number of different directions.
I think one of the things you alluded to that's really interesting about PM&R on the rehab hospital side of things is it's not just about stabilizing a patient and getting them home. It's about getting them home as close to baseline that they're used to, meeting their needs. Like you talked about, a patient is in a, you know, catastrophic accident, you know, they might be in the hospital for 6 weeks and they slowly start to regain function. But then it's like, how do I get them home to their most functional baseline, right? It's not just, obviously, you know, there's a component of stabilizing, of course, and it's not to say like, you know, CHF patient comes in, you just give them some meds and send them on their way home and hope they don't come back anytime soon. Like, these are people that are disabled. And you know, in a short 6 week time frame, like you can see drastic changes. Like the first day that they're coming to your unit, they might not be able to move any of their extremities, but by the end, they're moving their, by week one, they're moving their fingers. And then by week two, they're moving their hands. And then all of a sudden they have full function of their upper extremity. And then, but they're not back to their baseline. And that's a challenge that they're kind of learning to live with. Their families are learning to live with. Oftentimes they're still like so incredibly motivated to, you know, get back to baseline, which is what I love about PM&R, is these patients genuinely want to be helped. Your rehab patients, they're like, I want to get better. I'll do anything it takes, because functionally disabled, and it's impactful to, you know, their daily lives. They can't work. They can't do their things they love. So I love that part about it. I think it's really amazing.
You know, I think another important facet of it too is that for the most part, when patients are coming over into a rehab facility, a lot of patients think, oh yeah, the workup is totally done. Like, we know exactly what is going on with this patient. You know, everything is nice, all buttoned up. All that's left is therapy and getting them back home. And that's not always the case.
At the end of the day, people come to a rehab hospital with these functional disabilities, but they also still have all these medical conditions that are being treated in an acute hospital, right? So I need to know how to manage, you know, blood pressure. I need to know how to manage a patient's chronic kidney disease. I need to know how to manage their CHF and their COPD. Like, these are all things that on top of them dealing with, we have, you know, other things. PM&R touches on every field. Like, you know, you really mentioned earlier, you know, the neurology aspect of it, the musculoskeletal orthopedics aspect, but it's also medicine, and people don't necessarily realize that. So,
and I mean, not only that, but there's a lot of cases where you may not have a specialist that will be available to come into your hospital also. So I know that there's several facilities where you go in and say they've got, you know, 60, 70 patients. They've got one IM doc. And I mean, are you going to tell me that one IM doc is going to be able to manage every single one of those patients? I mean, if they can, oh my gosh, wow. I don't know what their time management is like, but it's phenomenal. But being able to, you know, still be able to handle all of these things and know, hey, this is when I'm over my head. This is when I need help. I need a little bit of guidance. I think that that's why it's really valuable to still absolutely have them there. I sometimes wish that there was more of them. But then at the same time, part of that is perhaps my own wanting to have extra security type of thing. Like, hey, I'm not making this mistake. And I think that as we kind of grow as residents, as physicians, I think that all of that will kind of come in time as well too.
Yeah, I mean, I know I feel drastically more capable, competent, confident than I did 10 months ago. You know, it's crazy how far we've come and all the different things we've learned. And I feel like, you know, I feel like we've gotten a really strong education here and learned from some great doctors. So I'm really excited to take that with me because I think I'll really be able to excel at taking care of my patients, which, you know, is the ultimate goal. So that's awesome.
I'll say that I've been extremely thankful for all those physicians down here that we've met. It's been an insane ride throughout this year. Just trying to learn as much as we possibly can, you know, both with a hospital system and then taking care of patients and being able to do so efficiently because there's something else coming through the pipe right now that you have to deal with, you know, kind of suddenly sometimes. And I'm truly in awe of my colleagues' ability to be able to do that.
So now moving into residency, you guys are finishing up your transitional year, the intern year that you'll do before going into your 3 years of PM&R. And then whatever else fellowship or attending jobs you decide to come after that. But tell us a little bit about, you know, what you really enjoyed about this year and the transition into being student to resident.
So I was really nervous going into residency. And it's kind of funny because I think about it the same way where I am now, like coming into residency here as I'm going over to my next program. I was really nervous about the people. You know, I'm generally a pretty introverted person when it comes down to it. For me, meeting a lot of people, not knowing what they were going to be like, I just get very nervous in social situations. And so I think the best part of residency for me has honestly been just connecting with a lot of the residents that have been down here, being able to be a part of this new program in this facility and frankly, this city. My gosh, like they've been so welcoming to us, you know, and they've truly just opened their arms to us and trying to do everything they can to make sure that we enjoy our time here, that we are supported. I think that there's a lot to be said for that. But then, you know, as far as the residents are concerned, every single one of us, it just seems like we've all tried to kind of open our hearts and open our minds to one another and try to help each other and kind of support each other wherever we can to get through this time. Because, you know, I mean, as you were saying before, there's a lot of hours, there's a lot of pressure. One thing that I'm truly thankful for is that while there's a lot of us that we're competitive, you know, I mean, you kind of have to be just a little bit competitive in order to get into medicine in general. But we're all, I feel like all of us would put any competition aside if we see that somebody is struggling, especially one of our fellow residents. And we would gladly stop what we're doing to make sure that they are okay and to see what we can do to help. And I think that was been one of the best parts about this experience is seeing that in one another and watching as we all kind of grow together and go through this. And I will say that I'm truly sad that I'm going to be leaving this group of people. Everybody's just been so phenomenal. I would love to stay here with everyone.
Yeah, it's hard. I feel the same. You know, obviously there's 18 of us. So, there's a lot of us. You would hope that, hey, maybe there's one person you kind of gel with. But, you know, all 18 of us have great camaraderie. I think it's going to be really hard to fill that void, especially for, you know, my program's, I think there's a total of 6 of us. Your program's also smaller from what I understand. Mm-hmm. So not having the numbers and kind of having people to be comfortable around is going to be something I'm going to miss, you know, significantly. Obviously, the hospital is great. They treat us well, but the people make the day-to-day obviously very bearable. So it'll be definitely an interesting transition, kind of relearning the whole process again, and obviously kind of getting our first real exposure to being physiatrists, which, you know, I've done PM&R rotations, you've done PM&R rotations, but there's certainly a different gap between doing it day-to-day and having some like that little exposure that we've had. So I think there's going to be a lot for us both to learn, but I think we've been set up pretty well and hopefully you know, obviously these are connections we're going to have for the future. And, you know, Bryce and I were lucky to go to a PM&R conference a couple months back where we did a poster and, you know, just building that camaraderie with people and seeing that I think we're going to have for, you know, years with ourselves and our other PM&R co-residents this year. It's going to be really cool to see kind of where we're at 10, 15 years from now, what we're doing and, you know, how we're able to help our patients, because there's so many unique ways we'll be able to do that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You have to keep going to all the conferences. And what we kind of like to do, just wrapping it up, is any advice or insight that you have for people who are thinking about this journey, anything, you know, words just to leave.
So I guess I have two things that I want to make sure that I express to people, and they're kind of like completely different topics from one another. The first one is it's okay to be scared, you know, because it's more about what you decide to do when you're scared than it is about the actual feeling of being scared itself. And I think that that comes to a lot of different aspects in both being in medicine, but also in life. For myself, was absolutely terrified when I decided to leave a career position with retirement and benefits and everything to move across the country when I frankly did not know that I would be smart enough to be a physician. And I, in my head, was making contingency plans for, okay, what am I going to do if I fail out of my first year of medical school? Like, now I have no career. I have all of this debt from undergraduate. I have, you know, first year medical school that I have to pay for somehow. What am I going to do then? And I was making all these contingency plans, and it scared the heck out of me. But part of that means that you're growing, especially if you're pushing through it, because you're deciding to move yourself forward as long as it's in that positive direction. And that's just kind of how I think that we can all become better human beings. And when it comes to medicine, I'm far more comfortable taking care of patients now than where I was a year ago when we started this. And I'm far more comfortable now than when I was a paramedic, but I'm still scared. And I think that that's good, to be honest, because frankly, I'm scared that I'm going to miss something. I'm scared that I'm going to overlook something. As long as that continues to fuel me forward, to make sure that I'm doing the best that I can for my patients and to make sure that I, you know, you use that to constantly learn and move forward. I think that you need to know that that's okay. And I think that that's a natural and normal feeling that a lot of us experience, but we don't necessarily express it to one another. And then the second thing is, you know, I was kind of wondering if you would ask me it. You know, I think to myself, you know, do I wish that I had gone through this sooner? Do I wish that I had decided to become, you know, a physician, you know, in my early 20s instead of just doing the EMT and kind of going through 8 years or 10 years or whatever it was before I went into medical school? To be honest with you, I would not trade that time back, because that's made me who I am today. I think that, you know, when it comes down to it, we've all made choices in our lives that put us into one area or the other, and we can always wish and hope that we could go back and change things, but it doesn't do any good. And quite frankly, all of those experiences are what brought you to where you are today. And I think that you can leverage those experiences in a lot of different ways that you would never expect in order to help you with a lot of things. Like for me, a lot of people think that me having been a paramedic will make me be a better doctor just because I had that baseline of medical knowledge. And frankly, I don't think that's necessarily what it is. I think it helped, but I think it's just because I was able to connect with people and I learned from an earlier age, so to speak, but from an earlier time, that's what really matters for most people. And I would never take that back. Because if I think about it too, like that would have made it so I never met my wife. I would never want to take that back. And that's exactly what that would do. So be grateful for where you are, no matter where you are within your journey and within your path. If this is something that you truly want to do, always just keep that why in mind and try to get the support of your loved ones. And
those are incredibly valuable words of wisdom.
Yeah, and that goes to say that it's true for any field. Continuing to learn, it goes into, you know, driving you forward day to day and not getting tired of, you know, where you are. And Rebecca and I talk about our journeys and how every step of the way, good, bad, it all kind of built up to where we are today. And we have great lives and we're very fortunate for everything that we've come across and the people we've come across and the relationships we've built and all the experiences that we've had that are going to ultimately make us better doctors in the future, better spouses and everything. So it all plays into it. And I just want to say thank you for joining us. Obviously, you're our first guest, but I knew this would be like an episode that, you know, I'll listen back to because I know the kind of great guy you are. You drive me forward every day. You're an impactful person to me this past year. So I'm very thankful. And I know people are going to listen to this and be like, wow, like I can do that too. Like maybe they were drawn away from medicine for a reason. They didn't think it was for them, but you know, it's never too late. I joke with you that you're older, but that just means that you're much wiser than I am. So I am very thankful to have you around this past year. So with that being said, I hope that as our podcast continues to grow, this will be something that we'll share with people. And hopefully your story, you know, continues to be heard by people to, you know, push them forward. And
you know, it's kind of ironic too, is without the whole soap situation, we wouldn't be here right now. But thank you too, really, for taking the time to come share your story with us. We really appreciate it. And I know a lot of people who listen will too.
Well, truly, thank you guys. Y'all are phenomenal. I think you're doing great things, being able to get a lot of this information out. And frankly, it's something that I wish I had as I was kind of going through the process, you know, because there's a lot of questions, especially, frankly, as somebody who is a non-traditional student going in through things, you don't know, honestly, what you can trust and what you can't trust. And I think that those kind of goes a long way to be able to kind of help walk people through certain things, have expectations for themselves. And I just really hope that somebody was able to take something away kind of from this and from my journey. And truly, it's never too late, you know, to move forward. I mean, we always joke that I'm older, you know. I mean, when I finished school, I know somebody who had just started and I think she had just turned 50. I think about that, you know, and would I make that same decision? But then I also think, you know what? Could you imagine what their why is? Could you imagine what their driving force is? When you kind of look back at it, in my mind, I always just think, you know, this is probably the person that doesn't want to have the regret, you know, of not having moved forward with something that was truly their dream. And if this is truly your dream to do this, then take it and run with it as fast and as hard as you can. So.
Absolutely. I'd love to know her why too.
You know, thank you for sharing your totally unscripted, personal, vulnerable story. That kind of adds to, you know, not just like study hard and go to school and, you know, everything works out, you know, everyone has personal things that happen along the way that will make you second guess and make you kind of step back and say, nope, let's turn around. Let's just, you know, stick with this job and let's just stay comfortable. Right. And that's medicine will make you uncomfortable. It will challenge you. And it certainly has for us and clearly for you too. So thank you for sharing that. Appreciate it.
And we'll have you back on when you finish up with PM&R.
That sounds great. I'd love to.
Thank you for joining us today. We'd like to remind our listeners that the content provided in this podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only and represents our personal opinions. It does not reflect the views of our employers or any other organization we may be affiliated with. This podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition. The views expressed by the hosts and their guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. Thank you for listening.